Today's edition of the Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Life Change Tea.
Why go to getthetea.com? Because this important news could change your life. Socrates made a statement saying that all disease starts in the gut. Take care of your gut, and well, the rest speaks for itself. Life Change Tea is a wonderful way to aid in your digestion. Brew it, steep it, drink it, and feel it go to work. We at Life Change Tea have been around for years helping people just like you feel better. Lots of testimonials and lots of happy people. Log on to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Getthetea.com.
Alrighty, hello again everyone and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for the 22nd day of May 2020, and I am being accosted. Yes, my formerly 2-year-old daughter, who was a pain in the butt, is now my 3-year-old daughter as of today, and so she insisted on saying hello to all her fans. Say hello, Quinn.
I want to go to the grandma pool in the bathing suit.
That's not hello. That's a lot of words, but it's not hello. You're like Nancy Pelosi. Just say hello to everybody.
Hello, buddy.
There you go. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday.
There you go. Yeah, she turned 3 and she got an inflatable pool. But the water's too damn cold. Maybe by Saturday it will be warmed up by nature. And not deflated by nature. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host and the father of the birthday girl. Big interview edition of the Daily Caller podcast as we send you into Memorial Day weekend. Our guest, my guest, I don't know why I always pluralize it. It makes it sound like this is some big operation. It's me sitting in a basement with a 3-year-old now. It is Matthew Whitaker. If that name sounds familiar, it's because it should. He was Jeff Sessions' chief of staff when he was attorney general, and he became acting chief of staff when Jeff Sessions resigned. He has written a book, Above the Law, and we get into that. We get into all sorts of things. It's a really fun, good interview. Really liked the guy. You can watch the video at the Daily Caller on the Daily Caller YouTube channel, or you can listen to it. You can, I suppose, if you've listened to it, you have listened to it. Never mind.
Daddy, it's that's you.
Yeah, what's me?
That's you.
That's not me. That's the clerk's movie poster. I just had the attitude. It's a really interesting, fun interview, informative. We get into the deep state. We get into Jim Comey. We get into the whole deep state gang and the cabal of the Obama administration that set everything in motion to try and kneecap President Donald Trump, to try and destroy the Trump administration. And it's pretty dangerous how close they got. And it's also pretty dangerous to how close they're going to get to getting away with it. So we talk about all of that and more. You're going to like it. You're going to want to buy the book. The link is provided in the post for this post. And if not, you can go to Amazon and look it up. It just came out on Tuesday, so it's brand spanking new. Plus, I didn't know that that Whitaker played tight end for the Iowa State Hawkeyes back in 1991. He played in the Rose Bowl, so there you go. A bit of trivia and things you'll learn on this program. You will like it. You can email me, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. Monday's show, I'm taking off Monday. I take off the radio on Monday. Still have to write a column for Tuesday on Monday, but I can deal with that. It'll be nice to have 2 whole days off a week. It's going to be wonderful. But I'll replay the interview with the American living in China, because lots of people liked that. I think it's worth listening to again, and I don't think this issue's going away anytime soon. So you can relive that. Before we get to the Matthew Whitaker interview, let me tell you about GetTheTea.com. Yes, that's right, GetTheTea.com. That's a website, ladies and gentlemen. It's the tea that makes you go, Life Change Tea. Called that because it will change your life. It'll help you go. It'll keep you moving. It'll clean you out. And then you'll get more energy because the food that you put into your body will get more of the nutrition digested out of it. You go to getthetea.com, you pick out your flavor, you pick out, they have a whole bunch of products there, shop around, throw it in your cart at checkout, the promo code Derek, D-E-R-E-K, click apply, you get free shipping on top of everything else. Great products. I've been hearing testimonials from you guys since they started advertising, and I have been hearing great things from the company, from you guys patronizing them, repeat customers. That's the best testament to any company you can possibly have. You can get anybody in the door once, but do you get them to come back? And GetTheTea.com does it. All right, let's get to the Matthew. I hope you're able to get outside this weekend. I am planning on, even though I have to make a cake for Quinn's birthday, I don't know, one overboard, this kid's going to turn out to be a monster. Let me just tell a quick story. I know, you can fast forward past this if you don't like the. I get the email, stop talking about this, and come on, man, get to the news. Well, we talked to Matthew Whitaker about the news. But I remember 2 days. I remember more than 2 days. I remember at least 3 days. The day that I found out that my wife was pregnant. I assume she suspected that she was pregnant. I guess. I don't know. But I used to go up to, I used to have to drive an hour to work to do radio in Baltimore back in the day. Three years and nine months-ish ago. And my show was from noon until three. Then I'd have to drive home. My wife was producing, we had a really screwed up schedule. We had one car. My wife was producing morning radio, so she had to be to work at 4 a.m. She would get home by 10:30, and I would have to leave right then, take the car, to get to work for a 12 o'clock radio show. Now, I had already sent in all the prep and everything. And then I would have to leave immediately and get home by 4 because my wife had to be back at her work at 4 to produce the 5 o'clock show. So it was just nonstop, go, go, go. And I come home to pick her up, and normally she's running late because she's always running late. Little did I know she was late this time in this way. And she comes bounding out and has, like, I don't know, a spring in her step. And she's going to work. She's been up since 4:30 or whatever. Not normally a spring in her step. And she comes in, and we'd pulled the goalie and had decided to try to have a kid, but weren't, at least I was. I was doing whatever needed to be done, but she was paying attention to ovulation and all this stuff. I wasn't. I said, I don't want to know about that stuff. And, yeah, I know I'm a typical guy. So she comes out, and she's got this big shit-eating grin on her face. And I'm just like, what's going on? And she hands me this stick. It's a pregnancy test. And I look at it, and I don't know what the hell it is. And I see the plus or whatever it was. And then I realized that there was two things. First of all, she just handed me something she peed on, which I know how it works. She didn't pee all over the whole thing. And secondly, it was, oh, my God. Holy shit, this is now. I guess part of me was excited, but I was mostly scared to death going, oh my God, this is real now. Because we'd talked about it, and I don't know, I was never one person who wanted to have kids. I didn't like kids. They were other people's kids, other people's problems. And here I was holding a pee stick in a Mini Cooper going, holy crap, we're going to have a kid. And she's going to torture the cats. Leave Ringo alone. Get out of there. And I'm like, holy crap. So I drive her to work, call my parents, tell them. They're excited. I'm in shock more than anything else, but sounded excited. And then I was terrified from that moment till this moment, pretty much. And then the day that she was born, 3 years ago today, it was a Sunday. And I was getting ready. Getting ready to go to bed. And my wife's saying, very pregnant, saying, I think I might be having contractions. I'm not really sure. And she's timing them. And I'm just like, no. I'm trying to talk her out of it. Like, no, not ready. Not ready. No, it's just fake. She calls the doctor and says, well, your contractions are whatever, 20 minutes. I don't know what they were. They were far enough apart that it didn't matter. And, well, we don't know for sure. Call me when they're like 5 minutes apart. So she gets up at 3 a.m. and goes to work at 4. because there were two guest hosts on her radio show. Nobody could get into the building without her there to let them in. So maybe someday Quinn will listen to this and be get down. What are you doing? She's gonna make it to her fourth birthday. So she goes to work. I go to bed. About 6 o'clock in the morning, I get a phone call, and it's a good thing that I heard the phone ring. Probably I was scared to death and not really fully asleep. And she says, my water broke, so I'm going to the hospital. I'm taking an Uber to the hospital. She'd taken an Uber to work, and so the car was at home. And I said, okay. And she said, just come up there when you can. It was no like, oh, my God, get there or anything. She was very calm and cool and collected about it. I was not. And I was half groggy, and I rolled over, and I said, all right, well, I'll go back to sleep for a little while, and then I'll wake up. And my work was on alert that this could happen at any moment anyway. So I laid there probably about 10 minutes, not really being able to sleep. And I remember thinking, I'd better get out. She's going to kill me if I don't get up there in some kind of decent time. She's just going to kill me. So I get up, I take a shower, I feed the cats, I make sure everything's there. I don't know how long this is going to be. And I go to the hospital, I call work, and they got it covered. And I go up there, still kind of in weird denial that a human being is about to happen. And I'm going to have to, you know, be responsible for it, at least partially. And I get there, and I got there about 8 o'clock in the morning, 7:30, something like that. My wife had been getting stuff from the printer at her work, and her water broke. These two guest hosts come in. She comes in. She gives them the paperwork. She cuts up some more audio. She says, orders an Uber. Says, my water broke, so I got to go. The lady from the newsroom is going to take over and calmly just handle it. She's been calm and cool and collected through the whole thing. What are you doing, Quinn? Get out of there. Come here. And she's laying there in bed doing nothing in the hospital. And it wasn't until, Quinn wasn't born until like after 11 o'clock. I was kind of hoping it would be after midnight, because then she would have gotten an extra day to stay in the hospital. But it was after 11 o'clock. My wife's parents had time, it was that much time, to fly up from Florida. They bought a ticket, hopped on a plane. Like, that's how much time it was. They showed up at the hospital. And finally, Quinn was born. We'd had the name picked out. My mother had picked it out before she passed away. And my mother didn't pass away for like a year after that. But she'd picked out the name, and we named her that. I kind of manipulated the situation to make that happen. That's a story for another day. I had a whole list of names. We went to Ireland, and we're like going to have these lists of names of all these things. And I had one that I really wanted, and another four or five that were pretty good. But I couldn't just say, well, I want Quinn or La Bufa or Snot. I had to make it a good sales pitch. And I did. I was surprised my wife had like one lame choice. It was terrible. I can't even remember what it was, but it was lame. So we had the baby. I didn't want any. I don't want to see what's going on. I stared at the wall. I put a mask on my wife's head when she wasn't pushing. And her parents were helping the doctors. And I'm sitting there thinking, you doctors are getting paid a lot of money for this. Why am I helping you? You know? And they go, you want to cut the umbilical cord? I said, hell no. I don't want to see the kid until it's washed. Like, I'm not one for blood and guts and yuck. So then, held her, saw her. She was not as much of a brat then. Remember when the day you were born?
Yes.
I don't think that's factually accurate. And yeah, then I went home and fell asleep. And started it all over again. I had to write a column that night too, I think. And I also got my book deal while that was happening, while she was in the hospital. Quite a time 3 years ago today. So happy birthday, Quinn. Happy birthday. And here she comes. Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
And the website, if you want to help out the show, is patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast. You can email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com. There's really no address at the moment because the Daily Caller is in the process of moving, and I don't know what the new office is or when it will be opened. But it's Matthew Whitaker time. I thank you for indulging me while I recount this story, mostly for Quinn in 18 years when she can be wildly embarrassed by some of this somehow. And have a great weekend. Grill some meats. Have some fun. Get some sun. And if you have an inflatable pool, fill it up now so it can warm up by Sunday and you can lay in it if it's hot enough. Happy Memorial Day. Here is Matthew Whitaker.
All righty. Hello again, everyone. Welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller podcast, a Friday video edition for the 22nd of May, 2020. Lots of twos out there if you're looking for a lucky number. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. And as you can see, sitting there in the split screen with me in a semi-Brady Bunch opening moment is Matt Whitaker, former acting attorney general of the United States and author of the new book, Above the Law, the inside story of how the Justice Department tried to subvert President Trump. And Lord knows they tried to do that. Welcome to the show. What is your title? Because, you know, the former attorney generals are always attorney general. Is your long title former acting attorney general?
Pretty much. I mean, a lot of people just say General Whitaker or Hey You or Matt or Mr. Whitaker. You know, I respond to all of them. And, you know, obviously serving this administration was an honor. And but I'm glad to just be sort of back to being Matt right now.
Well, congratulations on the book. I know how it's as close as a man will ever come to giving birth unless we get kidney stones. But it is one of those things that it's a long process, and there's a lot more to it than people who haven't done it think. So I know how it's like to break the tape at the end of that 26.3 miles. So congratulations to you on that. Before we get into the book, I want to talk a little bit about your bio. You grew up in Iowa. You got the Hawkeye helmet behind you. You played at Iowa. You were tight end?
Yep, tight end.
Kind of built like a linebacker. You didn't think?
Well, I'd much rather. It's interesting. So I'm in the Iowa High School Football Hall of Fame, and I played both offense and defense as a running back, if you can imagine that, and a linebacker. Went to Iowa. I was an outside linebacker, defensive end when I first got there as a freshman. And then I just decided I wanted to play offense. It was more kind of what I knew and enjoyed. And so I became a tight end. You know, Iowa has really become tight end U. Last year, they had two tight ends drafted in the first round of the NFL draft. And so it's, you know, it was a great place. Again, I used my scholarship for education, got my undergrad, MBA, and law degree all from the University of Iowa, some while I was still playing on the team. And so, you know, Iowa is obviously, and the University of Iowa is very near and dear to my heart.
I grew up in Michigan, so that's all we need to say about that. But I'd much rather try to tackle you than have you try to tackle me, just because you look like you can hit. I'm glad. I bet a lot of people were glad you were on offense.
You know, while I was the funny story I talk about in this new book is when I was chief of staff to Attorney General Sessions, more than once I was asked if I was his security detail and not his chief of staff. So
I could see that. Let's talk about it, because you grew up in Iowa. You ran for office a couple times in Iowa. How does a cornbread guy from Iowa end up being chief of staff to the Attorney General of the United States?
Well, you know, you think you have a plan for your life until you realize that, you know, God has a plan for your life. And I really, you know, I was in the Department of Justice in the Bush administration. I was the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa as a very young age. I was 34 years old when I got appointed by President Bush, and I was the youngest U.S. attorney whose father was not a United States senator, and that's because Strom Thurmond Jr. was U.S. attorney at the time in South Carolina. And so, you know, I knew a lot of the folks in the incoming Trump administration. I knew, you know, obviously the folks at the Heritage Foundation and the Federal Society and those, and I was working on a project that was, I had one foot in Iowa, one foot in D.C., and ultimately, you know, I was just asked by Don McGahn and others in the administration to Ryan Priebus, Steve Bannon, to consider coming into the administration. And ultimately, they thought that the best place for me was to be Attorney General Sessions' chief of staff. I'd only met General Sessions once before that, probably in 2014 timeframe. And, you know, we just kind of hit it off. We both have a love for college football. He's a big Auburn fan, comes from a very football-rich state. And, we spent 13 months together, and we, you know, a lot of accomplishments. Obviously, his recusal was difficult and bifurcated the leadership at the Department of Justice. And so it made it harder to accomplish the mission. But at the same time, I think we had a good working relationship.
I want to get to the recusal in a second, but just from a logistical standpoint, I worked at the Heritage Foundation for 5 years, then went to work in the Senate as press secretary. Being chief of staff to somebody is essentially being their representative when they're not around. You're sort of the filter through which everything passes. Without knowing him, only having met him once, how was the adjustment period of you deciding what gets to Attorney General Sessions? Because, you know, what you consider important might not necessarily be what he considers important.
Yeah, we had many meetings that we spent. I spent just, you know, all day, every day for several months with him, around him, understanding sort of the ebb and flow of the work, and obviously the priorities. And one of the things I was there to do for him, and one of the things he asked me to do, was to control the process and streamline the process, whether that's having the meetings not run over, keeping a schedule, which is in those, you know, with those executive positions is so important, you know, making sure he's prepared for meetings. But at the same time, you know, kind of making sure that the important issues get to him sooner rather than later, and make, you know, one of the things I was continued to, you know, always be working on was, you know, once, and this is a funny kind of story I tell in this new book, is that, you know, when something comes to the Attorney General, a decision comes to the Attorney General, that really means that there are 110,000 other people in the Department of Justice that don't want to make that decision. So, you determine whether that's the right place for the decision to be made, and whether or not maybe it's a better decision for the Deputy Attorney General or someone else in the chain of command. And ultimately, you want to make sure you know what's going on, that you have your finger on the pulse of the Department of Justice, and that you build strong relationships, not only with your principal that you're on staff for, but also making sure that within the building and nationwide and worldwide, that you have strong relationships to have a good, you know, network of folks that can tell you kind of what's happening.
How nerve-wracking is it the first couple of weeks on the job where you're like, should I take this to him? Will he find it annoying? Or what if I decided that, and then you sit there and go, oh, crap. What if he really wanted to weigh in on this?
Yeah. It's, I think we found opportunities to have conversations that were, you know, maybe like 5-minute stand-up conversations about an issue. And I could see if he was interested. The one thing that about Jeff Sessions that I learned is he's interested in almost everything. There wasn't too much that he hadn't experienced either in the Senate or as a state attorney general or as a U.S. attorney for 12 years in Alabama. And so most of the issues were very interesting to him. And so oftentimes, you know, it was just I spent time reminding him what his priorities were, that he had articulated what the president's priorities were, most importantly, and then trying to make sure that the time was allocated to that. Because as you can imagine, you could have briefings on so many different issues at the Department of Justice that could fill the schedule and then some, but really not actually drive the most important priorities that the president had set out already.
Let's get into, because above the law details a lot of everything we've only read about from the 30,000 foot level, not from the inside. And you're almost really the first person to give the inside look, not only as somebody who was the right hand of the attorney general, but then became attorney general for a period of time. When the recusal came, and it was a manufactured recusal, James Comey has admitted he tried to get the special counsel appointed. There was a push to, from the very beginning, even before Sessions was appointed and approved, to say, well, you recuse yourself. Should you recuse yourself? When the recusal came, it came through a recommendation from the ethics office, I believe. Did you agree with the recommendation that Attorney General Sessions needed to recuse himself?
Well, so he recused himself in about March of 2017, and I didn't join the department until October of 17. So I was not there at the time that decision was made. I, having had to do the recusal analysis myself, I certainly know how personal that is and how facts and circumstance based it was. But I also know that his recusal certainly hamstrung what we were able to accomplish in the attorney general's office, because obviously the deputy for the purposes of the Mueller investigation was the attorney general. And, you know, that created some tension that's already naturally there between the fifth floor and the fourth floor, as it's called at DOJ. But, you know, I having done my own recusal analysis and determined that I did not have to recuse from the supervision of the Mueller investigation, I certainly know the pressure he felt. And I also know, you know, kind of how what it's like to deal with career ethics officials. And, you know, they're almost complete, you know, biases to say you should recuse because that's the safe space for them.
Retroactively, do you think he made the right choice?
Again, it's such a personal issue. You know, I know that his recusal was broad as to how it applied to a lot of different things, including the Mueller investigation. And so, you know, I think he wrote an open letter to the people of Alabama explaining why he believed it was the right thing to do. And I just, you know, since I wasn't there, I have a hard time kind of in retrospect criticizing that decision. But I do know it had a dramatic effect on our business at the Department of Justice.
So as your chief of staff and as you're helping run the Department of Justice, this investigation is going on. The auspices, Robert Mueller was not an independent counsel. He was a special counsel through the Justice Department employee. With the attorney general recused, with you as chief of staff, were you allowed legally to be kept abreast of what was going on?
No, because General Sessions was recused. His entire staff was recused from the special counsel investigation. And I remember, for example, when the Russian troll farm was indicted in 2018, and the deputy attorney general was having a press conference. I remember about 20 minutes before that press conference, having a meeting with Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, and his principal deputy, being briefed on it for the first time, not having any idea that, you know, that was about to happen. So it was that type of suddenness and lack of visibility that, again, made it difficult to manage from time to time in the Department of Justice.
Were you consciously avoiding news stories about it the way the attorney general was?
No, I was. I mean, I read and I watched, you know, TV every night and read news clips every day. I was just like an ordinary citizen observing it from the outside, though, and seeing the leaks, like when the New York Times said that there were many contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. You know, I was surprised by that, which turned out to not be true at all. And we saw that in the Mueller report. So, I mean, I was seeing the same twists and turns as everybody else. Obviously trying to keep my eye on the agenda and driving the priorities of the attorney general and the president.
Eventually, Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Sessions, I keep wanting to call him Senator Sessions, resigns. And in the immediate aftermath of that, you as chief of staff become the acting attorney general. How shocked were you when that happened?
I was very shocked, and I think, you know, there's a picture I include in this new book of me shaking his hand on that fateful day. And, you know, I showed up that day, that morning, as I ordinarily did, you know, commuting in from a D.C. apartment that I had moved to. And I left that night with an FBI security detail and two armored SUVs. And so it was a dramatic day. It was a stressful day. There's been, you know, news reports of kind of what happened on the inside. And, you know, oftentimes those types of news reports, as you, I'm certain, know, are from someone's unique perspective in order to accomplish their narrative. But, you know, it was a dramatic day and it was a surprising day. And at the same time, you know, as I laid awake that night listening to the SUV idle for, you know, outside of my apartment all night, I would tell you, I was, I just knew that I had to, you know, kind of assume the role. And
does the president call you? Does the chief of staff call you? How do you find out that they want you to run the show until they find somebody?
Both. I mean, I remember as I showed up that morning and about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, there was, you know, just a sudden kerfuffle, let's call it. And, went in and found out what had happened. Chief Kelly had requested, that changes be made at the Department of Justice. And that was causing the attorney general to decide to resign. And early that afternoon, I got a phone call from the president asking me to perform the duties of attorney general. I have some, I don't know if you can see it, but there's a signed letter from the president of the United States, which is a very interesting historical document that I received, which was, which, you know, it's addressed to me as chief of staff of the Attorney General, and it says, you know, you are to perform the duties, and you know, until replaced, of the Attorney General. So it was those were heady days, and I go back to that moment, and I can remember it and see it in my mind's eye pretty clearly.
I bet. So you went from chief of staff not being involved in any of the information related to the Mueller investigation to being acting attorney general and free to get briefed. And you start getting briefed as having been a consumer of news and hearing all these stories about the Mueller investigation, the leaks and the anonymous sources, to actually getting the direct information. Then what hit you? What shocked you? What was this? Was there a moment where you're like, this is way different than what I was hearing or reading in the New York Times?
It was the first briefing. And the first briefing started off saying that the Mueller investigation has found no evidence of a conspiracy or any relationship between members of the Trump campaign and the Russian government. And I immediately thought to myself, this has been a complete waste of time. And this, we need to get this over with. I mean, I was also briefed on several outstanding matters, including that, you know, Roger Stone was a target and was about to be indicted. And then that, you know, I was also led to believe that the writing of the Mueller report was underway, and I expected the entire time I was acting attorney general that I would receive the Mueller report. And I thought often about what I was going to do when I received it, because of the DOJ regulations about that. And, you know, the report was supposed to, you know, address the decisions that were made. And that's why I had that famous press conference that I talk about in this book, that, you know, I stood up and I said, you know, I expect a report, and I expect, you know, to review the decisions that were made soon. And that, I mean, that was, again, it seemed like everything I did and everything I said was just caused a cataclysmic response from the, you know, breathless media that were, you know, hanging on every word of the Mueller investigation, looking for any news information. It was disappointing to know that that dominated the entire time that I was at the Department of Justice. I'm glad ultimately that we had the report, that the report said what it said, although I still believe, you know, what I was led to believe on the second part of the report, the attempted obstruction of justice, that really what was happening at the time was, because there was never any evidence, and we, you know, again, we have the Mueller report, we have these hipsy interviews about all the Obama officials saying there was no evidence of collusion, we have Strzok and Page and their text messages saying no evidence, you know, there's no big there. And we have this counterintelligence investigation on January 4th of 2017 was about to be closed before they did the General Flynn investigation without predication. And so, you know, I look at all this evidence of no collusion, and I just think it was setting a obstruction of justice trap for President Trump and for myself and others that could have, you know, put our thumb on the scale and somehow got into, you know, the crosshairs of the special counsel. I think, you know, one of the themes of this book is that this can never happen again. And, you know, we need to ensure that this never happens again by following regular order at the Department of Justice.
That regular order wasn't followed, everything you just described, and then some, and we're still finding revelations today. When you found out, hey, there's nothing here, there's no collusion, and that was supposed to be what the Mueller investigation was about. And then you wait and you wait and you wait, and there is no report forthcoming, and the investigation is still going. Was there this thought, this is an investigation looking for somebody to indict, looking for a crime rather than an actual fact-finding investigation? It seemed to be, I don't know, as Attorney General, what were you thinking? And was there anything you could have done or anything you did do behind the scenes to sort of say, let's wrap this up, fellas, there's nothing here. There's nothing here.
Yeah, I talk about in the book that I brought a U.S. attorney in to help me manage the Mueller investigation, because I knew that if I tried to directly interface and manage it, that ultimately it would dominate everything I did and would take all of my time. And so, you know, Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, who was before I took over supervising the investigation, had the principal deputy who was the daily interface. And so I brought in Greg Scott, who's the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California. He and I were both U.S. attorneys in the Bush administration as well. He went in private practice, came back. I brought him out to Washington, D.C. to sort of interface. He was an elected county D.A. up in Shasta County, California, and he was the right person to do the interfacing. And, you know, and we had many discussions where I was trying to drive, as appropriately the conclusion, because, you know, again, because of the original briefing and what I knew is that the investigation was over and that the report was being written, and I could not understand why it was continuing to take so long, you know, why it had already taken beyond the election to get resolved, and then ultimately, you know, not getting until Bill Barr came in, and 6 weeks after I left did they get the report, and then, you know, you see what it is, and I knew that that obstruction of justice piece that I had been told really wasn't a legitimate theory in the first place, and not because of the Office of Legal Counsel opinion, but just because there was no evidence of it, that suddenly that was half of the report. It was really, I was very disappointed, and it's kind of one of the reasons that I determined that, you know, I need to write a book and tell this story, because this is not the way it should happen, and it should have happened.
Let's talk about Andrew Weissman, because it was just revealed this week that he's now going to be headlining a fundraiser for Joe Biden. He was at Hillary Clinton's victory party on election night 2016, not particularly happy, yet he ends up being the right hand of Robert Mueller, maybe even both hands, depending on how involved Robert Mueller actually was. What kind of person did you find him to be, and what kind of... how would you characterize his work on this investigation?
Well, and that's one of the hardest things is, I mean, he's known to be a bulldog. He's also known to be overly aggressive. And you've, you know, there's, I highlight in the book some of those examples of where he was overly aggressive. I also think, you know, we saw Bob Mueller testify in front of the Senate and House. And, you know, it was very clear that there was not a full cognition of what was going on as part of that investigation. And I found that to be very disappointing. Andrew Weissman is, you know, showing exactly what he's always showed, which is he's a partisan. You know, he supports the left, and, you know, he's never really answered the question of, did he do his own recusal analysis on his biases? And regarding President Trump, the fact that he had, you know, gone to the Hillary Clinton, you know, what was planned to be a celebration party, but ultimately wasn't. You know, and other data points, you know, that have been, you know, publicly available. It doesn't surprise me that he, you know, would be a draw for the left. He is a hero of the left because he is seen as part of the resistance and the opposition. But I don't know how you can look at the Mueller report and not see that everyone on that investigation, quite frankly, took too long, spent too much money, and ultimately had no evidence ever that the investigation should have been justified, predicated, or otherwise continued, not only against President Trump, but against really the entire thing. This is where I really believe, and it's one of the themes I discuss in this book, is that this investigation could have easily been handled internally by U.S. attorneys and by career prosecutors at the Department of Justice without the appointment of a special counsel.
Was Rod Rosenstein in error, or did he? Is there? Because he seems to kind of be one of those guys who aggravated both sides, kind of wanted to play both sides against the middle. He'd say some things in public, then say other things in public that would throw a little bit of meat in each direction. Did he make the wrong call the day after the recusal to appoint Mueller?
Well, so here's what I would say about that is, and I discuss the Deputy Attorney General in my book, and I discuss his decision making and his personality and, you know, to his 29 years at the Department of Justice. But what I would say is when, you know, Andy McCabe, right after Jim Comey was fired and the memos were leaked and, you know, Jim Comey did it to prompt a special counsel, knew exactly what he was doing. I think Andy McCabe, though, and Jim Comey had discussed this concept, you know, in case of fire, break glass type of situation. And, you know, I think what should have happened and what Bill Barr has put in place for this exact situation is, you know, the Deputy Attorney General should have reviewed the predication for why the evidence for why President Trump would be made a target of the investigation, thereby triggering the special counsel regulations. I just don't see any record, and I have it's never been explained to me what the predication or the factual basis for President Trump exercising legitimate constitutional power by firing an FBI director, how that somehow makes him the target of a criminal investigation. I asked this question in the new book. I have never been able to get an answer. And I know that, you know, some folks are like, well, you were the attorney general. You should have been able, I mean, you can only ask the question of all the people and have them look at you dumbfounded and say, I don't know. I mean, Andy decided to make that decision, and just to think, well, that's interesting. And so I think history's got, there's still more to learn from this episode. But yeah, I think that decision, and I hope that Lindsey Graham has this hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee, or hearings, brings all these folks. I hope the Deputy Attorney General testifies and sets the record straight, because again, I don't want to suggest that somehow, you know, he didn't review the predication decision, but I think he should have challenged the predication decision, especially since I cannot point to a single time. And I laid out 2 years really from the Obama administration until the report was delivered, where anyone suggested, other than Adam Schiff, anyone suggested that there was evidence of actual Russian collusion with the Trump campaign.
How frustrating is it to be the attorney general, to know what you know, not really be able to talk about it publicly all that much because it's an ongoing investigation, but then seeing the exact opposite being disseminated on cable news nightly, hourly? Adam Schiff up there, he might as well be speaking Russian. He's a puppet of Vladimir Putin. Right. And you know the truth, but you can't say it. How frustrating is that? What's that sense like? Is there a temptation to call up Maggie Haberman at the New York Times and say, listen, Maggie, I got something for you off the record, but how do you deal with that? Because I would blow my top. I would freak out. I'd have to call a press conference
and tell these people. And you know, unfortunately, you know, all the reporters in Washington, D.C. are very sophisticated. And if you were to do that, suddenly, you know, you'd be just wrapped up, you know, and twisted in a knot. And I respect and understand that, you know, we do not talk about ongoing investigations. It is drilled into you as a, not only as a U.S. attorney, but also, you know, when I was chief of staff and acting attorney general. And I just wasn't going to be like that. I was disappointed that, especially, it's usually and always members of Congress that are, you know, get any kind of tidbit of information and then share that, you know, with the complicit media. But, you know, it's also, there's so much recklessness in these chuckleheads, former DOJ officials on TV, especially, you know, Obama era, you know, DOJ, U.S. attorney types, that just wildly speculate, that, you know, just like literally will take whatever's in the newspaper that's a anonymous sourced article and then, you know, make that gospel. And it's, you know, it was disgusting. And, you know, unfortunately, it's just how quickly the, you know, the 24-hour news cycle moves by. That was our daily, you know, diet of news for 2 years. And now it's just like, poof, it's gone. And there's no accounting. There's no responsibility. There's no hanging a lantern on these folks that got it so wrong, but were so, you know, righteous about what they believed was happening. It's just, you know, they're sick people. I've heard the president say that before. And I believe it.
They truly are. And what's amazing to me is these so-called news organizations who pay a lot of these people now know for a fact that they were lying to their audiences. They told a different story under oath, and there's been no reckoning. There's no concern. There's nobody even suspended, let alone fired. The concept of the deep state, you cover that in Above the Law. You get into this permanent class and this liberal permanent class. How real is the deep state? Because there's a lot of people who say that's just a conspiracy. There's no such thing. It's just paranoia and Republicans, conservatives looking for an excuse. And there are other people who will point to how this mid-level bureaucracy managed to manufacture a two-year investigation into the president of the United States and hamstring his administration.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And really, accomplishing a president's agenda is a legitimate and important part of, you know, the entire executive branch. And when someone disagrees with that agenda and tries to frustrate it, whether that's some of our Affordable Care Act litigation, whether that was sort of the Tea Party targeting settlement of those cases, you know, and a lot of other things that I could point to, I did interact with folks that just, you know, did not believe that we could pursue the president's agenda. And, you know, it was dependent on the issue, depended specifically on, you know, what we were trying to accomplish. You know, is it pervasive? Is it everyone? No. I mean, there's amazing and dedicated professionals in all ranks of the Department of Justice that I interacted with that ultimately just wanted to do the right thing for the right reason and understood, you know, that the president could set the agenda and we had to accomplish it. And we weren't doing anything unethical or illegal. You know, it was just a policy choice. And, you know, I would often say, and I said a couple times, and I describe, you know, in this new book, how, you know, I would have to counsel some of these folks that didn't want to do something or had to lead people that didn't want to do something and say, you know, your choice is to, you know, run for president yourself. Put, if you, you know, you run on this policy that you think is, you know, an antithesis to what you believe, you know, win an election. That's, you know, that's what folks, I think, just, you know, they get these permanent career spots oftentimes, and they just, they think that somehow that gives them any power and discretion to make policy. And it's just, it doesn't. I mean, what, you know, winning elections, both for the legislature, but most importantly for president, allows a broad discretion of policy setting. And again, as long as it's legal and ethical, I think that's, you know, that's where the inquiry ends. And then, you know, we should salute and do our jobs in executing that policy.
I got to ask you about the players that we know. And you're no longer acting attorney general. You're no longer in the employee of the Department of Justice. So I want to ask you, if you will, for your opinion, because you write a lot about James Comey and what he did. And you just spoke about how he sort of manufactured this leak in order to try and trigger a special counsel. Who in of the Strzok, the Page, the McCabes, the cable news pundit roundtable that they've now formed into, do you think any of them broke the law, or did they just act unethically?
So here's what I would say is, you know, three of them that you mentioned, Comey, McCabe, and Strzok, are all on the cover of my book. And there's a reason they're on the cover of my book, because, you know, two of them, Comey and McCabe, have already been looked into and referred through the Inspector General's process for consideration for prosecution for leaking classified or government sensitive documents. You know, I think Strzok was fired for violating FBI policies. I think all of them committed illegal acts inconsistent with, you know, the law. You know, obviously, you know, this, I'm so shocked by it. I have to keep talking about it. And that is, you know, that Susan Rice memo that says, you know, the president said this has to be by the book. And Jim Comey said this is going to be by the book. And, you know, really on 4 days later after she wrote that, Jim Comey did exactly the opposite of what, you know, the book, which is the Justice Manual, says as to how to, you know, interview senior level administration officials. So, I mean, I think that, you know, Jim Comey was feels that he's smarter than everybody, feels that he is intellectually superior and more moral than everyone. And that guided him and his arrogance to create a culture and do these things that were inconsistent with the Department of Justice. And he used a very sophisticated experience as a U.S. attorney, a deputy attorney general, an FBI director to manipulate these things so that, you know, that people like General Flynn would be caught up in a perjury trap or, you know, and could potentially set a trap for the president of the United States because he just appears just didn't like him.
Is there any accountability? Do you think these people will ever be held to account? They raided Roger Stone's house at 5 o'clock in the morning with CNN cameras and the SWAT team.
I was acting attorney general at that time, and I was horrified.
They didn't give you the head. They told you that the indictment was coming, but they didn't tell you that they were going to arrest him.
I knew that he was going to be indicted, and you know, the actual arrest and the, you know, sort of the how the arrest was executed was never briefed to me, and I was outraged. And I said that at the time in my, you know, how famous House Judiciary Committee testimony where I told Jeremy Nadler his 5 minutes was up. I talked about, you know, sort of that, what I believe.
Who made that call then? Who had the authority to send in the SWAT team?
You know, that's that ultimately those decisions are made at the operational level. And that was, so that would have been a supervising agent in charge that would have made the decision how to execute that. And then who made the call to tip off CNN? Who knows? I mean, there were some relationships with CNN at the time in the Department of Justice, but I mean, those are always very hard to prove or demonstrate. It's a shame, and it was a shameful act, whoever leaked that knowledge. But to get back to your question, you know, when I was traveling around the country after being acting attorney general, giving speeches and talk, interacting with sort of, you know, folks that I would run into. That was the main question I would get, is anybody going to be held accountable and why aren't people being held accountable? And I think, you know, General Barr just gave us some insight into that. And the Durham investigation does have criminal targets. And that's what he said. I know everyone was disappointed that Obama and Biden are not criminal targets currently. And I think that dominated the headlines. But what he did say was that there are people that are targets of John Durham's investigation, and he is building a case. And so I actually think people will be held accountable in this regard. And I think, you know, one of the purposes that I had in writing this book was, I thought, to point to who I thought had done illegal behavior and were not living up to the high standards at the Department of Justice.
In addition to the three men on the cover of Above the Law, is there anybody else you think deserves to be indicted?
Oh,
reminding you're not the acting attorney general. This is not official policy. This is just your opinion.
Right. Yeah. I think obviously it's a very high bar to charge people with crimes. And I don't have a full understanding of what facts John Durham has at his disposal. I'm going to let John Durham and the General Barr and others involved look at the facts and apply the law. I think this is what's so important as we, you know, one is we don't make the political criminal. That's a chapter in the book, and that I talk about how we need to make sure we don't just willy-nilly throw around that, you should be charged with a crime, et cetera, et cetera. There are people that break the law that don't commit crimes. And so we need to be able to, you know, charge those that deserve to be charged. Obviously, I think Andy McCabe is a prime example of someone that not only broke the law, was investigated for breaking the law. And I was, quite frankly, surprised that he ultimately wasn't charged with a crime. That decision was made after I left, and so I don't know everything that went into it, but it's certainly the information that's publicly available at that case, certainly suggests that that's somebody that should have been charged that wasn't. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, I trust John Durham. I worked with him. He did a classified information leak investigation for General Sessions and when I was his chief of staff. And so I'm very familiar with Durham and his work and his skills and abilities and how thorough he can be. And so I'm looking forward to the outcome of his review and investigation. And I think and I hope that he tells the entire story of how this all happened, because I think it's so important for the American people. And in this constitutional republic, we have to restore integrity to the Department of Justice, and changes have to be made. And I think it's one of the reasons Chris Wray has been under, you know, a lot of criticism lately, is he's been very quiet. And while I know he's making changes and fixing some of these challenges, whether it's FISA, whether it's criminal investigation predication or otherwise, I think, you know, Chris needs to speak and defend and explain some of these things that happened in the Comey McCabe era.
It's not even on his watch, but he hasn't exposed them. Rick Grinnell has been exposing things that I would have thought somebody would have won out there. Last two questions, and I appreciate your time. When somebody closes the last page of Above the Law, what do you want to stick in their craw, if you will? What do you want their takeaway to be?
You know, I want their takeaway to be that every citizen has a obligation to participate in our constitutional republic, and that we need good people from all walks of life, not just East Coast and West Coast elites, to make up our government. And the more citizen servants we have that come and serve and then go back to their communities to participate in the economy, the better we will be as a country.
And lastly, are you concerned that when we do get the full picture, when the Durham report comes out, and even when people read Above the Law, that there's just, it's too late? Everything is baked in the cake. People who are inclined to believe you will already believe you. And the people who are not inclined to believe you, there is literally no evidence that you can present to them, that you're never going to get Rachel Maddow to have that really was an abuse of power moment ever. Are we that far gone that they're just, where we are is where we're going to be, and it's where we were, and that's all it is?
I think there is a portion of our society, and it's certainly not on the, you know, hyper-partisan cable news networks, but there's a portion of thinking, rational Americans that I think are interested in the historical context and in my accurate accounting of my time at the Department of Justice, that are of good faith and sound, you know, minds that will look at this and say, you know what, there never was evidence of collusion with the Russians. And yet we had this 2+ year nightmare that was ultimately the Mueller investigation that included a criminal investigation of a president that was unpredicated. And we got to make sure that that doesn't happen again. And I lay out that plan in, you know, towards the conclusion of Above the Law, you know, this, my new book. And I think that's, you know, I think there are those people that are smart and rational that will understand, and it will help, you know, sort of explain how this happened and how we make sure it doesn't happen again.
Amen. From your lips to God's ears. The book is Above the Law, the inside story of how the Justice Department tried to subvert President Trump. The author is sitting right there, former acting attorney general and tight end. Which one was tougher?
Oh, acting attorney general was tougher, but I didn't get hit. So that, I mean, I figuratively got hit, but I didn't get physically hit.
There you go. Matt Whitaker, thank you for your time today. Good luck on the book. Congratulations on the book. That's all the time we have. It's a weekend. It's a long weekend. Go out and grill some meat or something. And if you're allowed to, go to the beach. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Monday.